This is Not the Average Real Estate Podcast by Not Your Average Real Estate Investor. Dipna Boholt used real estate investing strategies to completely replace the income from her accountancy practice with passive income in just 18 months and has since taught thousands of others to do the same. Welcome to the I Love Real Estate Podcast.
Hey everyone, it's Dipna here from iloverealestate.tv. And I'm here to bring you part two of the podcast series that I'm doing on a bit of a rundown on the whole crazy time that we're in right now, what it means economically, really cutting through all of the BS that's out there, the hysteria and all that sort of thing, and just coming down to the fundamentals of what's actually going on and what it means to us, not only now going through it all, but when we come out the other side, what it means to you then. So in part two, as promised, I'm going to be talking about the share market. I'm going to be talking about the health crisis that started in China and how that then created a demand shock, because that was the first thing that happened, that demand shock. That quickly became a supply shock, and then it kind of moved on a little bit more slowly into a credit shock and a lot of impact there on the banks. And I'll actually show you some charts on all that kind of stuff as well. And that then, the cluster of crisis that happened there has really become the financial crisis that we're in right now. So guys, sit back, enjoy, and I will be back to see you on the other side. And we'll do a little bit of a debrief on some of the things that I'm going to go through. So I'll catch you on the other side.
Not going to be the kind of bailouts that we've seen in previous crises around the world and the like, because the money's not there to do it for starters. But I'll get into what's happening there. So this is just showing you the current S&P crash as a result of the coronavirus and how much it's really come back. Here's another chart, so it's a very similar story and where we're at now. The crash in the US markets this month was so wild that it was a 160 billion year event. So it shows you how serious the share market is really taking this. And the share market sentiment is the worst it's seen since the global financial crisis. And the thing is, I don't believe there'll be as many bailouts for the companies, particularly in the US, as there were for in the global financial crisis. This is a chart put out by Schroders. And it's basically telling you the same story. When it comes to the stock market, there is carnage on the streets. And Australia is vulnerable. We start to have a look at hospital beds per capita. We have half the number of hospital beds per capita than Japan and South Korea. And on that measure, we're much more likely to be like the US and Italy than we are places like South Korea and Japan. Now we look at that chart again, and you can start to see, let's project that forward, let's project it out into April, and you start to see some very different figures if that's where we end up going. Now I'm not going to say that we will, I'm not a health person, but I'm a healthy person. But you've got health people coming out scaring the living daylights out of people at the moment. Like this guy here reckons that we're going to be, 50,000 dead is our best case scenario. And, 5 million infections and all this kind of stuff. Look, worst case scenario, 150,000 people dead. I personally, and I'm not medically trained, do not believe that we are going to be anywhere near those kind of figures. However, economically, there is going to be fallout. So let's put that into perspective. We've got a health crisis. Now, the way that the governments are dealing with that health crisis has turned it into a demand shock. People like waitresses and tilers and event coordinators and casual workers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all these people that now don't have jobs. Qantas putting off 30,000 people, Apple stores closing. The list goes on. It's created a massive, massive demand shock. But it's a shock that is timed to the health crisis. So it's all underpinned in timing. How quickly can we get this thing under control? Because all the evidence is showing that as soon as the health crisis is under control, the financial crisis will abate. The measures will be lifted, all the rest of the stuff. So that this part of this process, though, while we're in the middle of it, it also creates a supply shock, because, you know, projects get delayed because of fear and layoffs. You know, Australian Shop and Office Fitting Industry Association CEO Jared Ryan, he claims its members are looking at delays in projects of up to 6 weeks because of the coronavirus breakout. Is delaying the supply of projects from overseas. The longer the outbreak goes on, the worse that will get. So you've got the initial shock, oh my God, you know, we've got job losses, we've got all of these things. You've got a stimulus package to come in and back that up, going, well, we're going to double the job seeker allowance, all the rest of it, you're still going to have money to live, all of those sort of things. There will be other measures, I think, from mortgages and rents and the other types of things to come in there. And then because all of that shock happens, projects don't continue on. You know, you don't have as many people on the job sites doing this, building that, creating whatever. Consequently, you've then got an increasing supply shock, where we simply don't have the supply that we should have for the regular growth in our economy. And this really shows here, we've seen a massive drop off in construction. And now this chart is a little bit old, but it's worsened now. And that this drop off came as a result of the easing in the pricing, which was created by the Reserve Bank of Australia. I mean, RBA takes the cake for creating a mid-cycle slowdown, and I think a premature mid-cycle slowdown in this complete property market cycle, because of its total overreaction, too many powers, also it just got out of control, and they now realise that because they've gone too far. So now we haven't got the lending, we haven't got the flow in the economy to create the supply that we're needing, and I'll show you that in a little bit. The next thing is that creates a credit shock. So we've got a demand shock, we've got a supply shock, and then that creates a credit shock. Australian economy is set to experience low consumer confidence. I think we're experiencing that now. Not seen since the GFC, after the alarming surge in people falling behind in credit cards, mortgages, repayments, etc., as a result of the outbreak. Well, you know, we can call it alarming, but it hasn't really hit yet because a lot of people have only just lost their jobs in the last couple of days. The banking and financial transactions data from August to February shows that the bushfire crisis triggered a spike in debt repayments and consumer discretionary spending, and dictated the economy will take a far steeper hit from the coronavirus. And that's come out from, you know, the data that's been collected, etc. So a whole generation of business people have never seen economic circumstances like this. And we think many are unprepared. That's the reality. I don't think they're prepared for this. So the credit shock, you know, this shows you how, you know, it's come out from Westpac, and it shows you in recent times just how there's been this massive surge really, really quickly from a credit perspective. The devastation wrought on the Australian stock market by the corona pandemic has made it impossible for companies to raise fresh money, with two bank funding injections totaling at least $2.5 billion called off. Effectively, the window to raise capital is closed. So this is put out by Wilson Asset Management, who himself this week canned a plan. I'm just going to go to my other screen here. Canned a plan for one of his funds to buy between $10 million to $20 million worth of shares back from investors. Asked if he thought it would open again anytime soon, he says no. This month alone, after the great one-day fall on the Australian markets, the biggest one-day fall since 1987, NAB abandoned plans to raise about $2 billion by selling investor notes, financial instruments that pay a steady flow of coupons. If they'd proceeded with it, they would have been slaughtered when they came on because nobody would buy them. You know, the market has completely dried up for this stuff. Obviously, it's bad for the investors, but it's also really bad for NAB. Now, this is NAB talking about NAB. It's the same for all of the banks. What bank wants to issue capital at a massive discount? No bank wants to do that. So consequently, the bank's stock market share price has plummeted because it hasn't been able to raise the type of funds it normally would to be able to put more money back into their business and all the rest of it. So we'll move on. We've got the health crisis that's created a demand shock, that's created a supply shock, that's created a credit shock. And these three things have created a financial crisis. Now, it's a cluster crisis. That's what it is. And when you look at this is going on in every country. It's not just our country. So it's every country at the same time. Now, have I scared you enough yet? I want you to be real about this. I don't necessarily want to scare the pants off you. I'm sorry if I'm doing that. But what I do want you to do is take this seriously, because with every crisis, there is massive opportunity. And that's what I want to get to. So let's have a look here. If we go to the impact on property, what is that actually doing? All right. Well, the Aussie house prices in the GFC. Now, I want to go back historically because I want to show you what has happened previously to the Australian property market and the world property market as a result of a financial crisis. Now, the most recent one that we've had is the GFC. And this chart shows the percentage change in median house prices, not the median house price. So this is the percentage change. So as you see there, you know, we've had, go back to, the percentage change that we had straight after the shock of 2008, and we had a massive price increase. It then leveled off a little bit, and we're seeing massive price increase again towards the end of last financial year. If we move on, you know, we compare that to the most recent downturn we've had. The most recent downturn was twice as bad as the downturn during the GFC, with prices falling 10% a year at its worst. Point being, with the global financial system practically imploding around it, the Australian housing market barely stumbled. Why? Well, it's interest rates. Interest rates during GFC. As the GFC hit, the RBA cut rates aggressively. By the time they were done, they had cut interest rates by over 4% in a matter of months. And you can see what happened there. Now, as the GFC hit, you know, these rates went down very, very aggressively. And it's been the most aggressive and most sudden reduction of interest rates in our entire history in Australia. And it worked. You know, as borrowing costs dropped, the economy came back to life, and as people were able to take out bigger mortgages, sentiment returned to the housing market and prices soared. There were a few wobbles along the way, but the interest rates remained low and heading lower. As you can see by that previous chart I put up, there was a permanent shift in the housing market and the house prices moved higher. In fact, when the interest rate pulse combined with the income surge during the mining boom, it gave us one of the most spectacular property booms in living history. And it was all thanks to the interest rates and cheap money. So if we move across now to America, what did it do as a result of the GFC? And the GFC, you know, was very similar to Australia. America's first response to the GFC was to slash interest rates. However, with the financial system seemingly corrupt to the core, the US Fed had to cut rates by a massive amount. They cut rates a full 5 percentage points in little more than a year. You can see the chart that's actually showing that there. But then they had a problem. They had cut interest rates so far that they hit zero. They just couldn't cut rates any further, but they weren't out of the woods yet. So what were they going to do? They decided to get unconventional, running out options and ammos, and the US Fed turned to unconventional monetary policies. Specifically, those policies, they launched a massive financial instrument called quantitative easing. I mention this term because we're going to come back to this. Quantitative easing is a fancy word for printing money. And the Fed was printing and pumping billions of dollars into the economy every single month. And you can see that in this chart. It shows two charts here showing you, the quantitative easing and the effect that it had on the economy. Now, over those few quarters, nearly $3 trillion in printed money was circulated into the economy, with a total over the three quarters going to $4.45 trillion they printed and just pumped out into the economy to pay for stuff. Now, when you look at this quantitative easing, you know, and we look at the Fed and what it did and it brought back things, the important thing about the quantitative easing is where the Fed decided to inject that money into the economy. At first, they did it by buying government bonds, government debt, but they also realized they needed to support the housing market. So the Fed purchased massive amounts of residential mortgage-backed securities and assets backed by ordinary people's homes. And you can see that in this chart here, just how, you know, that money went back into the housing market. So think about that for a second. A crisis hits, and one of the first things the Fed does is throw trillions of dollars at the housing market. But you know what? It worked. Borrowing costs were for both businesses and households tanked. Mortgage rates, in particular, dropped like a stone. And that really saw the recovery in the US market. With the benefit of hindsight, this saved America from total financial collapse. Something weird started to happen, though. With all the money slushing around into the economy, real activity was failing to pick up. Unemployment remained stubbornly high, GDP growth was unimpressive, and inflation was practically non-existent. All that money had saved the economy, but the real economy wasn't improving. It was likely filling your car with petrol and the fuel tank still reading empty. Where did the money actually go? Well, I'll show you where it went. The answer is that it went into asset prices. Sure, some firms use the cheap money to invest in productive capacity, but more often than not, firms used the cheap money to buy back shares and push up their own share prices, for which the CEOs were handsomely rewarded. The end result was one of the most aggressive bull runs in the American share market that we have ever seen. Look at that. Until the recent crash, the American market had effectively tripled in value in less than 10 years, and all at a time when the real economy was posting pretty ordinary results. So when we go hard assets or fixed assets, the stock market is definitely part of that category. But you know what the other part of the category is? Hard assets also means real estate. It means real estate. So when we look at what happened in the real estate market, whilst it doesn't look quite as impressive as it did in the share market chart, it's still pretty impressive. And the reason that it doesn't look quite so wonderful is because we, at the time in America, you had a lot of ninja loans. Now, ninja loans are no income, no job, no assets, and they'll give you a loan. And back pre-GFC, that's pretty much what caused the GFC and the complete crash and everything else that happened with that. So we never saw that in Australia. We didn't go anywhere near what was called the ninja loans. And in fact, our defaults on low-doc loans was very, very, very slim compared to even just normal old P&I loans that are given out to anybody. So what's all this mean? Well, the key takeaway here so far is that cheap money means house prices go up. End of story. Cheap money, houses price go up. Low interest rates, house prices go up. That's the general rule. The next key thing here is quantitative easing. Now, this chart really shows how hard assets went up. That's the one on the left-hand side. But the real economy was failing. And the reason is the difference between the two is because the money was sitting in the housing and real asset market. So if you took away the housing market and you took away the stocks and shares, the actual economy and you know, the normal growth in the economy, inflation, you know, it was hiding because it was all in real estate and hard assets. Now, I promised to show you in the beginning the most important chart that you'll ever see in your investing career. Now, this is from a research house called Convoy Investments. What they've done here is that they're tracking the US monetary supply against a basket of shares. This is a measure that includes stocks, real estate, and financial assets. Now, remember I said this is the most important chart that you will ever see. You ready for it? Here it is. Ta-da! Isn't she impressive? All right, let's look at what it means. What you have here is that basket of assets against the monetary supply. And you can see here that they run pretty closely together. So what that means is when you print money, when the monetary supply grows, asset prices go up too. And periods of high asset price growth go hand in hand with periods of high monetary growth. Why is this so important? Why am I carrying on about it? Well, this chart here practically shows the same thing. It shows the relationship between the money supply or quantitative easing, as in printing money, and the value of the increase in core hard assets. So the takeaway here is printing money equals higher asset prices. Is this fair? No, it's not. Unless you are a property owner, and the more you own, the more profit you make. End of story. What are we doing at the moment? Da da da, look at that. America is out there massively printing money. And, you know, they're at it again. They're making it happen again. We looked at this in relation to the previous chart that I showed you. Already, they have printed $1 trillion in fiscal support. Now, that's gone into direct cash payments to households, support for state and local government finances, and liquidity support for struggling businesses. That statement was put out by JP Morgan. And this is just today. Tomorrow there's going to be more, and next week there's going to be more, and by the end of the month there's going to be even more, guaranteed. So what are we doing in Australia? What about our kangaroo court of quantitative easing, aka printing money in Australia? Where do we stand with that? All right, the RBA has cut interest rates pretty much as low as they can go. We're at 0.25%. There's only a quarter of a percentage base point to go before we're at zero. It has launched quantitative easing to anchor short-term rates of government bonds. Some analysts think this is worth about $50 billion, but it's open-ended. And the RBA has said that they will do whatever it takes. The RBA has also set aside $90 billion for a facility to support banks to lend to small and medium enterprises. And so far in the first quarter of quantitative easing, Australia is already north of $140 billion. So what does that mean? If we have quantitative easing going up, as in we're printing money, what happens is money flows to safe havens. That creates a fundamental drive, and there is a dramatic retreat to residential housing. Now, you might think I'm biased, and I am. Let's face it, I am. I'm biased towards property. But let's look objectively at what else is around there. What is deemed to be a safe haven? You know, back in GFC times, I was standing on stage saying Sydney and Melbourne house prices are going to soar. I was following Americans standing on stage saying Sydney and Melbourne house prices are going to fall by 40%. You should sell all your property and go and buy gold and silver. Well, what a load of crap that was. And look at this. If we have a look at times now, gold, for example. Now, gold is considered to be the wealth of ages. But if you look at what's happened to the gold price just recently, it's crashed. So it's not gold that people are flying to. What else have we got? Bitcoin. That's the big buzzword at the moment. It's supposed to be the digital gold. It's the digital safe haven. No, it's not. Look, it's fallen. It's absolutely crashed as well. So it's not Bitcoin. So what is it? Well, it's got to be property. And the reason I think that this is the case is because any of those things do not have a yield. They do not earn you any money. You know, if you think the key is gold, gold doesn't give you a return. It doesn't earn anything from hoarding it. And if your only objective is to get out of shares, then you may as well just stick the money in the bank. Gold is better than cash only in times of massive inflation. But nobody thinks that inflation is going back to, you know, anywhere near the heights that it probably should be sitting at anytime soon. It didn't emerge even with the colossal money printing that followed the GFC. So it's pretty unlikely that it's going to emerge now. So why own gold? Cash isn't losing value and gold doesn't give you a return. Why bother, basically? Whereas when we look at house prices, oh my goodness, different story. We saw massive safe haven flows into property following the GFC, and they proved to be very good investments. Not only did they protect wealth, they delivered a positive cash flow return and delivered very decent capital gains. Winner, winner. Chicken dinner.
Well, there's certainly a lot to take in there, isn't there? And you start to have a look at what happened back then with the quantitative easing and how it's impacting how it impacted the economy back then. And it's exactly the thing that's playing out here in America, in Australia. So the results, I believe, are going to be no different. Now, remember, instead of just listening to the podcast here, you can actually go to my website. And the website is iloverealestate.tv. And you can not only listen and then watch as well and see all of the slides and everything and all the charts that I give you, but you can also log on and you can get in one of my masterclasses. Now, I do a full-on masterclass. Now, this masterclass is, I think it goes for a number of hours there, but it really goes into a lot more detail than I'm giving you here. But if you'd like to jump on that masterclass, it is free for you. All you've got to do is go to my website, which is iloverealestate.tv, and you'll find it there. I'm also going to give you an opportunity to partake in a special consultation with one of my advisors on setting your plan. What you need to do to move forward and come out of this the other side, bigger, stronger, better. So that'll be all there as part of that masterclass. So jump onto the website, ilovereelestate.tv, and go through that masterclass that I've got for you there, because I know it's very extensive. There's a lot of information and I know you're going to get a huge amount of benefit from it. And, of course, take me up on the advisors having a 45-minute consultation with you on your road ahead. Now, remember, part three is coming up shortly. Part three, I'll be going through some of the housing fundamentals, the population in Australia and what that means. And then we're going to be, I'm actually going to have a very special guest come on, one of my strategists, and we're going to talk about financing and how the game has changed as a result of COVID-19. See you on that one, guys. Stay safe, stay calm, and start watching a different channel by now.